Well, thanks. I'm delighted to be a last-minute addition to the panel, which had to do with my own negligence in filing an abstract. This is a really impressive pair of presentations to follow. And in fact, a lot of what I might talk about in other circumstances, Kumaran's already talked about. My background is as a public health lawyer in the United States, started working on the AIDS epidemic 30 years ago. From a human rights perspective and a civil rights perspective. And then I increasingly became interested in the social science side of law. In other words, not thinking of law so much as doctrines and rules, not law in the books, but law in the streets, law as institutions and practices, beliefs that could be observed, and that, you know, whose observation was really the key, as we've just heard, to really understanding what's happening. You know, you can't tell much from what's on the books. You've got to look at what's on the streets. Public health law research was a program started in 2009 by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Wave your hand, Angie, because she was the program officer, Angie McGowan, who had the vision for this. And this was meant to promote more and better use of rigorous scientific methods to do that research on how law exists. And it wasn't that it never happened. It wasn't that we don't know how to do it. It just doesn't happen enough. It doesn't get the support that it needs. It takes too long to find out what works and what doesn't, and to find out where law is actually causing harm. So what I'm going to talk about today is some of the tools and methods that we developed in the course of that work that I think have a lot of relevance to the international situation and to something I've experienced working internationally over the long term, exactly the problem that we've just heard about, that we talk a lot about getting something passed, but attention to state, national level law, attention to local law and law broadly conceived in terms of policies and institutional practices and so on, we just don't see that. And that is where people actually live. They experience law on a particular street, in a particular community, in a particular city, not at the international level. Nobody actually lives at the international level. You know, in HIV, this is the traditional view. This is what I always encountered. I always found very frustrating. This is from the Global Fund recent strategy document. And we're always talking essentially about how important it is to have this enabling environment, the respect for human rights, this big principle. And that's about as far as we get in terms of the transparency of what's really happening. Now, something like the Human Rights Database is a big step forward in case law in making it easier to find out what is actually happening legally in the environment for case law. But when you look at the question of how you know, do we have this environment and is this environment actually working for us? Is it really true that having an enabling environment leads to less HIV or any of the other sort of human rights claims we make about health? How do we know? Well, you know, the usual knowledge base is pretty weak. There is almost none of this evaluation literature of any robustness across this area. There's some, but not anywhere near as much as we would expect to see given the profound importance that we believe that human rights has, or that we claim that it has. This I worked on the Global Commission on HIV and the Law a couple years ago as one of their technical advisors, which was a UN body that was looking across the board at how the legal environment was shaping and legal practice was shaping HIV and would shape it in the future. This happened to be one of my interests is criminalization, and this happened to be what the UNAIDS had tracking the law related to criminalization of HIV sexual behavior across the world. And basically, you can see that first of all, it was just this one big poster, which I tried to capture bits of. So, essentially a PDF, a completed document with X's and O's. And no transparency or real consistency about how it was made, no real sense, no ability for anybody on the outside to understand it and evaluate it from a reliability point of view. Often very difficult even, and certainly nothing like a link to the actual text like you have in the Human Rights Law Database. And for anybody who's really interested in understanding the law, you got to be able to see the policy, you got to see the text, even if you're not a lawyer. Now, in our program, we realized, even domestically in the U.S. where we focused, that the first step in trying to evaluate the impact of any law or policy is to actually capture the attributes of the policy in a scientifically credible, usable way. In other words, we had to turn the text of the legal document into numbers, because that's what you end up using in quantitative research. But of course, that's also how you end up taking legal information, which is huge and numerous in the sense of words, and turning it into data that can be combined with other kinds of data that then allows more sophisticated analysis for evaluation and other purposes. We eventually borrowed from some other pioneers in the world of evaluation research and law the concept of policy surveillance, the systematic collection and analysis of laws of public health significance. And we understood that to have several important uses. You know, our primary interest initially was to create data for evaluation. So we would create these data sets of laws and put them out in the world to be used by evaluators. But of course, we also realized that once we had data, we could publish it. It's very easy once you have digitized information these days to make websites, so we could allow people to see who has what law and who doesn't. And of course, when you think about recommendations that health agencies or UN agencies make, and they say everybody should have a law on X, virtually never will that recommender be able to tell you who has a law on X. And a year from now, they won't be able to tell you if anybody has adopted a law on X because they don't have the baseline information and they're not tracking change. We wouldn't tolerate that on too many other areas of health importance. I think we'd want to know if we make a recommendation who's adopting it. If we say increase treatment for HIV, we want to know has the country increased treatment of HIV. That's the measure. So that. But of course, that allowing stakeholders to track progress does more than just keep people informed. I mean, in almost any advocacy situation in any region of the world, whether it's a city or a province or a country, peer pressure and shaming are key tools. You want to be able to say to Scotland that they don't have the recommended policy that England and Ireland have. You know, that's just part of how you lobby. And sort of be able to see that and show momentum and track trends. And then finally, we thought too that, and I think this is something that the Human Rights Database for case law is the same thing. I think it's a plausible hypothesis that by making human rights and legal information more available to people who are not trained in those fields, you increase their capacity to do things with it. You increase their comfort level with it because it becomes easy to find and familiar. And people cannot find things on Westlaw. They can't even get to Westlaw. But they can go to your database and they can find things. And it's easily organized, it's accessible. It's not quite like going to law school, but it's certainly giving people all the advantage to interpret and see these things for themselves. So this is what law looks like when it's turned into data, right? There are no words, there are numbers. And this is important. This is really important from a cultural point of view because, you know, the recognition that one of the big reasons that non-lawyers don't feel ownership over law is that we lawyers don't let them have it. You know, we pride ourselves and have for 100 years in public health law on being these experts who know this stuff and we show you what it is and you listen to us and we tell you what's what. Whereas in fact, the truth about public health law and human rights is that non-lawyers do most of the work. They create the policies, they implement the policies, they find ways to spread the policies, they evaluate the policies. If we don't understand that law and human rights has to be truly transdisciplinary, we're really going to continue to run into that cultural problem that you described. So part of this is making it, you know, for us, part of what we wanted to do was to think about how we could use scientific techniques of lawyers to do a better and more efficient job in collecting the information. And we can actually. Doing legal research with a slight help from science is a lot more efficient than doing it as lawyers are trained to do it. But at the same time, it allows us to speak in a different kind of language and to have concern for the credibility and transparency of our data, which scientists care about, and to think about concepts in numerical or quantitative terms, which epidemiologists and other scientists understand. We built a software program called, in this iteration, it's called Law Atlas. And it is a program that is designed to allow people to do that coding, that scientific approach to coding in a really efficient way. So you can create a record and you can create a set of questions that you're going to code on and you can have your text next to it so you kind of do it minimal mistakes and errors. And you have multiple people doing it, so you have quality control, et cetera. So this is, you know, another contribution from sort of thinking about this from a scientific point of view is build a system for coding that's different from what law is done. So when you think of what law looks like for us, it's a series of records. You know, any law, any human rights instrument is actually something that exists for a span of time. It didn't exist, then it came into effect, then at some point later it was replaced. so it covers some geographic area, it covers some population, so that, and it had a particular text. And if the text changes, that's a new record. You know, that's a change. That's how you think about it in data terms, as of the old, you know, the old legal traditions that we would have had a Microsoft Word table, and when the law changed, we would have changed the X to an O or whatever we had, and you know, added a new column, and it would have been, and the past would have been gone. But in fact, trends are really important when you think about law and human rights, and as I talked before about tracking. And so then we developed this front end Law Atlas, where people can go and actually access both the data in quantitative form in a CSV or an Excel file, but also can actually look at it and see, you know, where we've changed, so that you can ask. You can ask questions, and I wasn't willing to risk actually going online and walking through this. But you would click on the Start Here button, and you'd select the variables you're interested in. You could see how they change. They vary across the states, and you can see how things have changed over time. We have a mini trend in syringe law. I never thought I'd see more states passing needle exchange laws, including states like Kentucky, but that's happened. And so there you see what it looks like when you click on the button and see the variables that you want to look at and select how the attributes you want to display. And in fact, you could also actually see the text of the law by clicking on any state or clicking on a table that this produces. So people can both see our easily accessible summary, but they can also look at the law itself. So to me, this fits into, I should say that although right now we've focused only on the U.S., within about 6 months we're loading all the countries and provinces and cities of the world. So we're in the midst of making this available for people who want to do human rights work, including, I hope, some people at this table. But to me, this fits into a broader story about, you know, again, I tend to think about human rights put into law, because that's the sort of the way lawyers think about these things, I guess, at least I do. But trying to understand not just the little pieces or the discrete elements of what we need in to take problems and innovative law and human rights solutions and turn them into widely disseminated, well-supported, evidence-based practices. There's some things we essentially need, and I've now started to call them the five essential public health law services, to emphasize the fact that we can't really do, not only can we not do public health without law and without human rights, but we can't do public health and human rights without some core elements. So we obviously have to have some kind of evidence base where, when there is expertise and knowledge about a practice, that people who are struggling with a problem can get at it. You know, can they get the recommendations about what they should do? Can they access people to help them innovate? That's surprisingly difficult, even in places like the U.S. Another piece is that we need lawyers available to help people turn those kind of policy ideas they have, those behavior change or institutional changes they'd like to see, actually turn them into instruments that can work in the given setting. You know, there is such a neglect of national law and national legal capacity in international health work. We get stuck on fixing the IHR, you know, the international health regulations, and we don't think about the basic public health laws of the countries that are struggling to comply with the international health regulations. We do not have that support for them right now. WHO does not do it, and apart from great groups like Lawyers Collective in isolated areas, we don't have enough of that out there. We have it, just not enough. There's a whole lot of politics here, and international law is great on the politics. I think we have a lot of advocacy across some of our key areas, but there's a lot of neglected areas that are not like HIV or tobacco or obesity, where we don't necessarily have global advocacy groups helping people work both globally and nationally and locally to get the political will to get the right policies enacted. So there's a deficit there too that's going to hold us back. And finally, there's an enforcement problem. There's definitely an enforcement problem, and that's true everywhere in public health. We have almost no capacity building for helping people actually take those lovely rules that have been passed, those lovely treaties, those human rights documents, those constitutions, and actually make sure they're enforced. Again, you have, you know, NGOs scattered around that do heroic work, like the Lawyers Collective or the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network in my field of HIV, but you just do not have anywhere near enough. And finally, there's this piece that I've just talked about, the policy surveillance and the evaluation, which ultimately is the thing that tells us what we should be doing. You know, there are two great tragedies, I think, you know, sort of preventable tragedies in international law and human rights work. The first is that we set off on campaigns to get somewhere, to advance a solution, and we don't have all these elements in place, which means that they fall apart somewhere. People kill themselves to get something enacted, and then it's never enforced. And the second is that we do not do anywhere near enough to take seriously our claims about what works in human rights and test those with evaluation and learn how to make them work better and learn which ones work better. So we kind of need these essential health services. I think what we've talked about today, getting greater comprehension of what's happening, seeing better the law, and the importance of evaluation are, you know, key pieces of this. I suggest that we have to, you know, be even more ambitious and recognize the need for really a whole supply chain of services that have to be there for successful use of law and policy.